Welcome to Ivan's DC Update podcast version. As you all know, what we're going to try and do in this podcast is explore the range of personalities, issues, people, and culture that help shape the way in which Washington, D.C. work, the city that we all love, live, and work in. In today's episode, we have two guests. We have one guest that will help us understand a little bit about where women and Republicans are going. Secondly, we're going to discuss with our second guest the growing clout of the Asian Pacific political world. For our first guest, welcome Brenda Giannini. How are you, Brenda?
I'm doing great, Ivan. Thanks for having me on.
Brenda is the CEO of Axis Research, where strategy meets science. So tell us a little bit about how strategy meets science, Brenda, and how you got to where you are.
Absolutely happy to. So I am the official nerd, the data dork on campaigns and in elections. I get to be the voice of the voter. So we do a lot of research and have thousands of data points on each voter. And I get to be the one that sits at the table and says, I'm not just piping off telling you what I think or what I think the best strategy is. This is what the voters want. This is where the voters want you to head. So I've been doing it for almost 25 years. I'm embarrassed to admit. My first race was the 2003 recall of Governor Gray Davis that resulted in the election of Arnold Schwarzenegger. So I came to D.C. in 1995, and I started supporting lawyers on the Hill, so people like you. So I was the mathematician providing data points to help form policy or kill policy or draft ballot initiatives, usually on the Republican side more often, defeating ballot initiatives. So that's my original start was with lawyers, and I did that for almost 10 years and had enough of the lawyer community. So then I got drug into the political side. And so after the Schwarzenegger campaign, I rolled right into the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign. And with an outstanding woman named Sarah Fagan, we ran the polling shop within that campaign. And from there, I had the bug and haven't really looked back.
Terrific. Of course, Brenda and I got to know each other when I worked as the head of the Washington, D.C. office for Walmart. Brenda was our pollster, so she was one of the best parts of us informing our strategy, and so she did a lot of corporate work as well. So Brenda, since we're here and we're talking, one of the things that we're trying to do with this podcast is sort of examine what the future is for Congress. And since we're in the business of influencing Congress, we're constantly obsessed not only with the members that are there today, but what the members that are going to be there tomorrow and the year after are going to be like. Coming off an election cycle, you know, like the one that we just came off of, it seems that Republicans are a little bit challenged with female voters. That's just a sense, and that's just what I read in the media. I'm not saying it's factually true, but you're a data nerd. You're a scientist in this field. So talk to us a little bit about women and Republican voters.
Absolutely. You were right. So 2018, definitely, by all counts, was the year of the woman. And everybody likes to say it was the year of the woman because we now have the most racially and gender diverse Congress we've ever had. But I think it's the year of the woman throughout. If you look at women voters, women showed up in mass. Women are, for the foreseeable future, probably for the rest of my lifetime, going to be the majority of the electorate. They're 52% of the electorate now. And you saw women protesters, women demonstrators, women running, and near and dear to my heart, women donors. Women are finally getting engaged. It's always been very hard to watch. Very successful businesswomen who just don't get involved with politics, don't give their dollar, don't give their time. And we've seen that change. And the biggest predictor in anything as far as participation in elections is having done it before. So I don't think that's going to go away. So I think it definitely was the year of the woman. On the Republican side, we are down to 13 Republican women in the House now, which I think, I'm not being dramatic here, I think that really is a crisis level for the sustainability of the party. It's going to be very hard for the party to survive when you look at that. So that's the bad news. The good news is we do see movement. So in 2018, over 600 years of Republican joint experience either retired, got defeated, or passed away. So we are looking at new faces rising up through the Republican ranks. And the party definitely gets it. The NRCC has already talked to 200 women that came out proactively to run for Congress. That's before we even started searching for candidates. So the party is very much focused on it. any campaign I've been on, back in the heyday, you might remember, any campaign we did, you had to have a seniors person, somebody that's focused on the seniors vote. How are we going to win the seniors vote? And now we see with all of our campaigns, there are multiple people targeting women. Where are suburban women at? Where are younger women at? Where are unmarried women? Where are married women? So every campaign knows that's a critical part of your strategy. So a very long way to say right now, I think that Republicans are at a crisis level with Republican women in the House, but we're starting to see the ship turn.
So the demise of the women participation with Republicans is largely exaggerated?
I wouldn't say it's exaggerated. What I will say is, so if you look at the last, well, going back, so 2018 was the sixth change election out of the last seven. So we're seeing massive changes. If you look at midterms alone, it was the fourth in a row. And what's really driving that is independent women. Independent women swing like nobody else. So in general, Republicans, Democrats tend to get their jerseys on. They show up and they'll vote for their party. Independent men divide pretty clearly on race, how they vote. Independent women swing. And I'm going to get kind of nerdy. I'm going to give you some data points, but we've seen how much they can change an election. So in 2010, independent women went for Republican candidates by a 10-point margin, and Republicans took 60 seats. 2014, same thing. Republicans won independent women by 12 points, picked up another 13 seats. Well, in 2018, Democrats won independent women by 17 points, and y'all got 41 seats. So independent women, not only do they have this huge percentage of the electorate, they really are the ones swinging it. So what that shows is they have the possibility to change again. They very much do not vote on party lines. And really, I would say independent women are what we used to call back in like George W. Bush days, soft Republicans. They've moved away from the party, but they still have that conservative bend. So they do have the potential to swing again. It's absolutely correct that they are not fans of the president, but they also, every time we talk to them, they consistently tell us there are Republicans, there are Democrats, and there's Trump. They don't see their Republican candidates as aligned with the president.
So you're saying there is a chance?
There is a chance.
So, Brenda, lastly, what's the bottom line? What should we know? What should we think about as we're thinking about women voters in the future?
I think women voters, I would keep my eye on them. They are going to be, I would not discount women voters, women donors, women protesters. They are the ones that are going to drive the issues that we're talking about in this election. That's why you see the Democratic Party so focused on healthcare right now. And they're going to drive the debates and they're going to demand a lot from their candidates. I don't think we're going to see, Joe Biden's getting away with it right now, but I don't think we're going to see a lot of sort of sleepy answers anymore. Women are going to demand plans.
Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you, Ivan. Great being with you.
Our second guest today is my good friend, Madeline Mielke. She is the CEO, I love using that term with Madeline, of the Asian Pacific American Institute for Congressional Studies. Madeline, tell us a little bit about yourself, your trajectory, your journey, and a little bit about your organization.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me today, Ivan. I really appreciate this opportunity. So again, my name is Madeline Mielke. I am the CEO and president of APEX, the Asian Pacific American Institute for Congressional Studies. We are the C3 nonpartisan educational arm for the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, otherwise known as KPAC. And KPAC is made up of all the AAPI members of Congress. And so we have 20 members of the caucus. And my counterparts are the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute and the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. And my personal journey is that I was born in Vietnam, came to the U.S. with my parents. My father is of German-American ancestry. My mother is Vietnamese. And we were one of the last American families to leave Vietnam in 1976. And I happened to be raised in the metropolitan area, went to a science and tech high school and ended up being president of the student body and ended up going into political science. And so I interned for Steny Hoyer when he was Democratic Caucus Chair in 1991, graduated in 94, and worked for the DNC in 1996. So my political career has spanned for almost 25 years at this point, and basically had my own political consulting firm for 16 years before I joined APEX.
Terrific. And now you are here sharing this great conversation. Madeline and I got to know each other while Madeline was in the fundraising business. So, Madeline, tell me a little bit about the growth of the AAPI political community.
Absolutely. So KPAC and APACs were formed 25 years ago, formed by former Secretary Nora Mineta and former Delegate Bob Underwood and former Congressman Bob Matsui, Patsy Mink. We've had a really great array of members of Congress really lead the charge in creating more opportunities for AAPIs to be in public service. And so we now have the most members of AAPI descent in Congress with a record number of 20. And so that to us in 25 years has been a really great trajectory. And we anticipate that we will continue to grow in the public service pipeline. And what's important also to recognize is that we are still underrepresented. We are 6% of the population and only 3% in representation in the federal level of government. And then when you start to consider that over 7,300 state legislators, only 46 are AAPI women, the number gets to be a little discouraging. So we are here to work on increasing that representation and provide more opportunities for people to see public service as an avenue to create legislation.
From an outsider's perspective, it seems to me that one of the most underreported stories of this new Congress and this new era in politics is actually the growth of the AAPI political, even the political clout. Even though it's underrepresented, you know, we hear a lot about women, we hear a lot about Hispanics, we hear a lot about the growth of African Americans in Congress, but the growth of the AAPI has been explosive.
Yes, and we are the fastest growing immigrant community in the country, and we anticipate that with new Americans coming in that sense of immigration, that we want them to also participate in the electoral process and understand that they have a voice. And so it's been found through data that when you have an AAPI running for office, regardless of what that office is, more AAPIs come out to vote. And so the encouragement that we try to provide is to have the community run for office, be a part of an active citizen participation. So being able to see them in a public role, whether they're a commissioner, whether they're running for school board or city council, that also increases AAPI civic participation.
So as you look into the future and you look around and you see the community and you see various data points out there, what gives you great hope? What are the narratives? What are the data points? What are the leaders that make you smile and think, whoa, we're going places?
Well, we actually have a lot of AAPIs who are in office that don't have large AAPI constituencies. And that to me shows that there's a shift in what people visualize as a leader. And so having an Asian American Congress member such as Andy Kim, who represents a district that's maybe 2-3% AAPI, is a great highlight. You have folks like a member in the Michigan State Legislature who's a woman, Stephanie Chang, who also represents a majority minority district that isn't AAPI. So you're looking at places where people are representing constituents who don't look like them and they're still seen as leaders. So that to me is a great way to look into the future.
So what's the bottom line for those of us that are trying to predict the future, that are trying to figure out, you know, who the big influence tastemakers are going to be in the future? When we think about the AAPI community, what's the bottom line? What's your advice to us?
One, don't ignore the community. You know, absolutely consider how AAPIs, if you have a large AAPI population in your district, how are you talking to them? We're not a monolith. We're also not the model minority. So we do have ethnic groups within our constituency who are struggling and need to be considered for when you start to think about resources being placed towards the community. You know, Census 2020 is so important to us, and we need to be sure that AAPIs are counted so that we have the resources to be able to cut the legislative seats, and that way representation becomes a little bit more representative of the people who live there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's it. That's all. It's politics. It's Washington, D.C. It's the life we've chosen for ourselves. And now the outtakes.
Brendan, tell me, what's your Netflix right now?
I don't watch TV. I'm like such a nerd, yes. But this is a sound check, so it doesn't matter, right? Okay.
Yeah. What's your son watching?
Stranger Things.
Stranger Things. Cool. Does he like season three? Does it work out for him as well as the other ones, or are you not that involved with?
I don't know. As long as it's on video games and the girlfriend, I'm good.
Sure. That needs to be an outtake.
Is that loud enough?
That's right. You're okay. Right.